Welcome to The Takeaway. Glad to have you with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and today I'm joined by Dorian Warren, co-president of Community Change, co-chair of the Economic Security Project, and he is my co-host for The Takeaway Deep Dives. Dorian, it's always so good to have you here.
Thank you, Melissa. You know, I love our conversations, and this one is a special one because March, of course, is Women's History Month. All this month, The Takeaway has been featuring conversations with and about women leading locally. And I have to say, Melissa, I have been loving your guest.
Listen, you are not alone. I mean, I have loved these conversations. We've already talked with Florida Representative Anna Eskamani, Ohio State Representative Amelia Sykes, and of course, there was this incredible exchange with Philadelphia City Council members Helen Gim and Kendra Brooks. It was just everything.
This is more like a sisterhood. Before I even decided that I would even pick up the mantle and decide to run, I reached out to Helen. I was like, what do you think? Her support meant a lot. You know, when you can identify with someone who has, you know, challenged the status quo and has to stand alone in places and still be a champion, to have someone like that come out and support you, it means a lot.
You can meet somebody like her, just a mom like me, and together we can prove to be a pretty formidable force. One of the things I love so much about this city and our community movements is that we believe in each other. Sometimes, unfortunately, we don't have anything else.
Okay, so we've established that this month is a great time to highlight women holding elected office at the local level. Now let me add another March highlight.
Is it March Madness?
It is that too, for sure. But this month also, Melissa, marks the 50th anniversary of a crucial moment in American political history. Melissa, let's go to Gary, Indiana.
Gary, Indiana.
What a wonderful name.
Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana, Gary, Indiana. That's the town that knew me when.
Well, I was thinking less of the 1957 Meredith Willson's The Music Bed version of Gary, Indiana, and a little something more like this.
Well,
I said, I'm going back to Indiana, Indiana, here I come, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, yes, I can take a little Jackson 5 Gary, Indiana, that's what I'm talking about.
Good, so picture this. It's March 1972. Nearly two decades since the Supreme Court declared segregated schooling inherently unequal in Brown v. Board of Education. 8 years since the Civil Rights Act desegregated the Jim Crow South. 7 since President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. And 4 since the 1968 Fair Housing Act, which prohibited discrimination in housing.
Okay, let's just be clear. Those are some of the most definitive legislative accomplishments of the 20th century. So I'm assuming all's good, right? Like President Johnson was certainly feeling very proud of what he and his administration, along with the movement for civil rights, had accomplished in what was genuinely a pretty short period of time.
And in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we affirmed through law that men equal under God are also equal when they seek a job, when they go to get a meal in a restaurant, or when they seek lodging for the night in any state in the Union. Now with this bill, the voice of justice speaks again. It proclaims that fair housing for all human beings who live in this country is now a part of the American way of life.
These were very real accomplishments, but it would be a mistake to think that all was well, because after all these years of social movements, advancing racial justice through progressive action, and the sharp rise in black elected officials, America was very much in the throes of a political backlash.
Because of course, all these hard fought victories for racial equality, they'd actually barely shifted the lived reality of so many African Americans living outside the South. And of course, that movement for Black power, that second wave coming behind the Civil Rights Movement, and it was consolidated and organized amidst the riots of 1968, but it was met with calls for law and order rather than economic justice. So that kind of sounds familiar, huh?
That sounds a bit too familiar, Melissa.
Yeah. So LBJ, that unlikely civil rights champion from Texas, he was really driven from office by the bloody spiral of the Vietnam War. And in his inauguration speech, Republican Richard Nixon, who succeeded him, well, he characterized that greatest decade of racial justice since the Civil War as a long night.
We have endured a long night of the American spirit. But as our eyes catch the dimness of the first rays of dawn, let us not curse the remaining dark. Let us gather the light.
Okay, everybody still with us here. It's March 1972. Richard Nixon is president. It's a couple of months before the events of Watergate would unfold. The Southern movement for civil rights is largely quiet. Cities across the Northeast and Midwest are rapidly changing as white folks flee to the suburbs and manufacturing moves offshore. And that's the moment in Gary, Indiana, when thousands of black people come together for the National Black Political Convention.
We demand that any party which asks our support acknowledge the inhumanity every black man, woman, and child faces in 100 different ways each and every day of his existence, up and down the width and breadth of this land.
Man, everybody was in Gary. Like everybody. They was all up in Westside High School. You had Black Panther co-founder Bobby Seale chilling right next to a young Jesse Jackson. Barbara Jordan, who would win election to the House of Representatives later in the year, she was in the House, as was the undisputed greatest of all time, Muhammad Ali. You had Harry Belafonte. You had movement widows Coretta Scott King and Betty Shabazz. And this was not just like a gathering. It wasn't just a conference. Gary was all about very serious and strategic business. And in fact, March 1972, Dorian, it's kind of the fulcrum, the turn, the transformation when the primary collective action of black people shifts decidedly, in the words of movement organizer Bayard Rustin, from protest to politics.
Yes, Melissa, and it was an unapologetically black politics. Just listen to this passage from the Gary Declaration, which adjourned the event.
If we have never faced it before, let us face it at Gary. The profound crisis of black people and the disaster of America are not simply caused by men, nor will they be solved by men alone. These crises are the crises of basically flawed economics and politics and a culture of degradation. None of the Democratic candidates and none of the Republican candidates, regardless of their vague promises to us or to their white constituencies, can solve our problems or the problems of this country without radically changing the systems by which it operates.
Indeed, the Gary delegates did not come to play. They departed with more than a declaration. They continued to meet, negotiate, and wrangle for another week after the initial convention. And they produced this kind of truly comprehensive document called the National Black Political Agenda. And the agenda called for black representation in Congress proportionate to the U.S. black population. It called for, and you'll love this, Dorian, a guaranteed minimum income.
What?
Right? In 72, it addressed pollution and environmental justice. So it was the first Green New Deal. And it addressed pan-African global development. And it really set out clear strategies for electing black local officials.
It was the California delegation that was responsible for the formation of a 50-man body to work in future months for the election of black candidates to local and federal posts all over the country. They will furnish campaign expertise and raise money.
Electing local officials. Now remember, this is where we began this conversation. And electing local officials is exactly why this convention took place in Gary, Indiana.
Oh, of course. Thanks for reminding me, right? It's Richard Hatcher who's mayor, right? He's elected in 67. And that's the same year that Carl Stokes was elected in Cleveland. They were the first black people elected to serve as mayors of major cities. In other words, cities with more than 100,000 residents.
Exactly. And Richard Hatcher was Gary's mayor. And in some ways, he was Black America's mayor. So it made sense that Gary would be the site of this historic gathering in March 1972.
Okay, so we've made it back around to local officials. But Dorian, we promised the people at the start that this deep dive was all about March, about Women's History Month, about women leading locally. So I think we're going to have to bring together all these pieces and introduce our guest.
I am Karen Freeman Wilson, president and CEO of the Chicago Urban League and the former mayor of Gary, Indiana.
Karen Freeman Wilson, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much.
Now, you were born and raised in Gary, Indiana, but you were still very young when the 1972 National Black Convention happened. Do you remember anything about it?
I absolutely remember the Black Political Convention. I was 12, so I wasn't that young, but I was certainly too young to participate. But my mother took me to Westside High School, where the convention was held for one of the sessions. And I remember seeing people seated on the gym floor and the fact that you had a sign from every state. The other thing that was noteworthy to me was that people were staying in our home. There was at least one or two people who stayed in our home who were strangers. I mean, we didn't know these people, but citizens throughout the community volunteered to host attendees at the convention.
Karen, we were just talking about Mayor Richard Hatcher. Can you tell us about meeting him and what role he played in your life?
Mayor Hatcher was just a larger than life figure, not just in the country, but certainly in our community. I first met him on the campaign trail. He was campaigning and my parents had a house party in our basement for him. Now, you know, we weren't big political folk, or they weren't big political folks. And so this was just a party of their friends. And I remember the generosity of his spirit, the fact that he wanted to elevate the status of Black people in Gary and wanted to create opportunities, because at that time, Gary was very much a segregated community still.
Karen Freeman Wilson. In 2012, she became the first Black woman elected mayor of any city in the state of Indiana. And today, she serves as CEO of the Chicago Urban League.
But back in 2016, she was a very different kind of CEO. While serving as mayor of Gary, Indiana, Karen appeared as a guest star in Undercover Boss.
I became the valedictorian of my high school graduating class. I went to Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and continued on to Harvard Law School there. During the summers, I would work in law firms in the city of Chicago. And there was always this sense, yeah, the money is good, but this isn't really what you're supposed to do. You know, it was always, you need to go back home. Oh, goodness. You all found that.
Well,
should have known.
What's important? No, it's so, yes, but very thorough, rigorous. So you go off to Cambridge, you stay for law school, you come back and work in law firms in Chicago, making good money, and then you decide to go back home. So tell us about when that decision to go back home.
I always knew that I wanted to go back home. In fact, when I wrote my essay for law school admission, my focus was always on returning to Gary. But a Harvard law education at that time, now they've gotten a little better now, but at that time didn't really prepare you to return home. The focus was really going to large law firms. And so I was conflicted for two summers, certainly conflicted by the dollars, but also conflicted by the messaging and the fact that I wasn't sure what my options were. I wasn't sure whether or not there would be other things for me to do, or that I would necessarily fit into my own small practice, or could fit into my own small practice, because I didn't hear or encounter a lot of small practitioners during the time that I was in law school. And it wasn't until I got to the prosecutor's office, because I ended up working in the Lake County prosecutor's office after law school, that I encountered defense attorneys who were engaged in private practice. And even though my friends were making much more money than I think they were making twice as much money as I was making at that time, I had a sense of fulfillment, and I had a sense of joy about the things that I was doing that really compensated for the money that I wasn't making, because, you know, I was living at home for a while. And even when I moved out into a dollar house. And so it didn't cost me a lot. And so I traded. I would gladly make that trade off today.
Okay. So now we're going to have to back up even just a little bit more, because I want to go back to, first of all, how a kid from Gary, Indiana, a little Black girl from Gary, Indiana, one, how did you even think to apply to Harvard? And then why in the world did the mayor have to talk you into going?
So it was my friend Kelly Shaw at the time, Kelly Squires now. And she said, we were in high school, not the last semester, but certainly our senior year. And, you know, so you get senioritis, and we weren't cutting class because we weren't those types of students. But we would take every opportunity to find our way to something useful out of class. And so it came over the intercom. Hey, the Harvard rep is going to be here. Come and hear what they have to say. So she's like, let's go. I was like, okay, let's go. And so we're listening to the Guthrie brothers, Rick and Carlton, and they're talking about having grown up in the Tarrytown area of Gary and going to Westside and going to Harvard. We were like, okay, well, Kelly was like, I'm not applying, but I think you should apply. And of course, good friend, influential, I applied, but I applied to Harvard just as, yeah, you know, I'll apply to Harvard because Kelly said apply. My focus was really on Purdue, on Notre Dame, and on General Motors Institute, because at that time, Black girls who did well in math and science were in vogue. Now, I was an excellent math student. I was just an okay science student. But, you know, they didn't know that because I still got the grades. So I was convinced that I should go to General Motors Institute because it was focused on engineering. It did not cost anything because you were able to pay your tuition through work study. And the most important thing for me was that I would have been able to get a discount on a black and gold Pontiac Trans Am. Black and gold being my school colors, Trans Am being the car that I really, really needed in my life at that time because I was 18.
Oh, Lord. I mean, listen, I ain't mad at that reasoning. And I think there's a lot of good reasons, actually, to not choose a Harvard and to instead choose a different path. But I got to say, thank goodness the mayor talked you into Harvard rather not. I mean, actually, did you ever get the Trans Am?
But Melissa, he really didn't talk me into Harvard initially because I went, I talked to him, and I still enrolled in GMI. It was not until I got to the Bedford Foundry. It was 110 degrees inside in July. And I was doing a time study. And the first thing I found out was I couldn't read and do this time study. And then there was a die-cast machine. I think I got 3 drops of molten metal on the side of my face. I had to go to the industrial clinic immediately. But the second call I made was to my mother to say, this is not going to work. I need to find another school. And then I said to her, call Notre Dame.
And they said they didn't have any housing. And then I said, call Harvard. So Harvard was actually the third choice after General Motors Institute.
It turns out that you end up at Harvard with some other pretty incredible folks, including the woman who goes on to become the first Black woman attorney general in the United States. Talk to me about what you learned as a Black girl and then ultimately a Black woman at Harvard.
Loretta Lynch and I actually chartered the Harvard Delta chapter. And that's right, ooh, back at you. And so we were obviously raised in a tradition of excellence by our parents, but we were able to pursue that at Harvard. And we pursued it in the Kuumba Singers because we were both members of Kuumba, but we also pursued it academically and as members of Delta Sigma Theta sorority. You know, Sharon Malone was one of our line sisters who is this amazing OBGYN, but also happens to be married to Eric Holder. Lisa Ross was one of our line sisters who's this incredible ER doctor in Harlem who was on the front lines at Harlem Hospital during COVID. Tracy Carroll was one of our line sisters. So we had a group of folks and we pushed each other. And all of us had enough of a connection to our communities that it kept us grounded. And so while I was always, you know, intrigued by corporate law firms, I always knew that my calling was to come back to Gary and help.
Now, there's this theory in political science called the hollow prize, and it kind of zeroes in on this moment we've been talking about around 72 that says that, you know, Black people were finally able to gain access to municipal office just as those cities were losing population, losing vital tax revenue. So even though Black folks won a prize as mayors, they found themselves unable to kind of enact the change they hoped to because the prize was hollow. When you became mayor in 2012, was Gary, Indiana a hollow prize?
In many respects, it was. I didn't look at it that way. I looked at it as the ultimate challenge. And for me professionally, it did, in fact, turn out to be one of the greatest professional challenges that I ever faced. But the thing that makes being mayor during the tough times in cities so important for Black mayors is that the commitment helps us to see past what many would consider a hollow prize. And the pride that we have, the desire to see our people win, is so great that it makes us work even harder.
Karen, I want to ask you about your current role as president and CEO of the Chicago Urban League and ask you to say a bit about how the work you do now is similar to or different from the work you did as an elected official. What are also some of the unanticipated things you've had to take on in this job that you weren't expecting to when you started?
So I always tell people our work at the Urban League, because we do programming and housing, entrepreneurship and economic development and workforce development and leadership development, and in youth and family services, is the exact work that I was doing in City Hall without the garbage, potholes, and the snow, and without all of the trolling. I mean, there is some trolling of the Urban League director because we are considered kind of the Black establishment in Chicago. But I don't experience nearly the animus that I did as mayor of the city, because it's almost the more you do, the more people expect you to do. And, you know, we came in saying we were going to run City Hall differently. We were going to raise the expectations. If you call City Hall, you should have your call answered, your request met, and, you know, you should expect us to deliver government to you. And early on, we were able to do that. And throughout our tenure, we were able to do it. But it's one of those things where if you accomplish one major feat, then the next feat doesn't seem as major because people expect you to accomplish the feat. And so it's also important to tell people what you're doing when you're doing it. Otherwise, they don't really see it themselves. And so now people are saying to me, now I see what you were trying to do. Now I see what you were doing. All of the things that you were planning are happening now. And I said, yeah, I told you guys that, but that's okay because I'm in a much better place. I was spending 6 days a week, 12 to 15 hours every day as the mayor. Now, the Urban League, many of my Saturdays are to myself. And even if I spend 6 hours on a Saturday engaged in something involved with the league, I think I'm winning.
This conversation is part of our series, Women Leading Locally. When I say women leading locally, what does that mean to you?
I immediately think about the Black mothers who lead in the PTA, who lead in the church, who lead and as a band parent, as my mother did. I mean, she taught me fundraising because she raised more money for band uniforms than anybody I knew. But I also think about my sister mayors and those who sit on the council who have literally caught hell. I think you said it during dinner recently when you said, but for the Black women leading in cities like Atlanta and DC and New Orleans and so many other places where Black women led during the onset of the pandemic, there would be a lot more deaths because we stood our ground. And I was so proud of these sisters as they literally had to fight with largely Republican governors to say, no, I'm not opening up my city. In Chicago, the mayor and the governor were on the same page, but the mayor was very early saying, we've got to shut down the city. And of course, the business community was in arms. But for those decisions, there would have been a lot more tragedies.
Karen Freeman Wilson, president and CEO of the Chicago Urban League and former mayor of Gary, Indiana. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you both for having me.
So, Melissa, thanks again for allowing me to go on this deep dive with you.
And Dorian, as always, thanks for being here to deep dive with me. Pausing for a moment, we'll be right back here on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and we're back with The Takeaway. Throughout the month of March, for Women's History Month, The Takeaway is joining forces with the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University to bring you the stories of women leading locally.
My name is Wendy Smooth. I'm an associate professor of women's gender and sexuality studies at The Ohio State University.
Professor Smooth is a scholar researching race, gender, and state legislative power. She also has a fabulous name. I've said it a million times, but I will say it again. Is there really any better name in the world than Professor Smooth?
Not a chance. Hands down, not a chance.
If I could find me a man named Smooth and marry him so I could be Professor Smooth, I too would be Professor Smooth. It's so good. So
yes.
As soon as we made this decision to have a series of conversations in March for Women's History Month about women leading locally, I said, okay, you guys have got to be sure that I have an opportunity to talk with Professor Wendy Smooth. Because I feel like when so many of us in the academic field of political science were still focused exclusively on the federal level or, you know, thinking about, women in Congress, you had already had told us, oh, yeah, no, you got to focus here at the state legislative level.
Sure, it remains one of the most exciting areas of government to study because it's really so close to home and so close to the issues that so many care about and so many people are attached to. Whether we're thinking about school boards, and that is all the rage in the news today, whether we're talking about state legislatures that are now educators, right? In the sense of dictating what our students should and should not learn in the classroom, to even thinking about the questions of voting rights. All of those questions at the surface often appear as national debates. But when we get to the level of actual decision making, those are all issues that are controlled at the state and local levels.
And
exciting and area.
It is, right? Again, you know, I so appreciate your point that, you know, if we're talking about gerrymandering or redistricting, that again, that can seem like a national story, but those are state lawmakers making those decisions in each of those states, right? In their committees with all of the various issues and even what it means to be, for example, a Democrat or a Republican can look really different state by state.
Oh, most definitely. What it means to be a Democrat in a Southern state legislature can be radically different than what we think of as a Democrat in a Midwestern state or even in a Western state. And so really, when we think about that old adage that all politics is local, we really are seeing that play out in state houses across the country and even again on school boards across the country.
Now, once we come down to the more local level, whether it is city councils, whether it's mayors, particularly of smaller cities, and of course at the state legislative level, then we also come to a place where there are more women, right, relative, for example, than the federal level, who are in positions of leadership, who are being elected and holding these seats for a long time. Tell us a little bit about sort of the shape of women in these local offices.
We definitely, because by sheer, you know, nature of the number, the vast number of offices, we have greater representation for women and for women of color. Though I will say there's, you know, of course, great work that needs to be done to increase the numbers of women we have in representative positions at the state and local levels. But based on the sheer, you know, vast number of positions, there are far more women who are representatives. And as you just pointed out, there's also the opportunity oftentimes for women to lead in those positions for extensive periods of time because term limits are often not as much of an issue if we go beyond the state legislative level.
So you've brought up school boards a couple of times, and they've been obviously, an important pathway often for women and particularly women of color to hold office. Talk to us about how it is that women end up getting started so frequently at the school board level.
You know, women are really great at stair-stepping through politics. And what I mean by that is that we often think that we must do the office that I can best imagine myself making a difference. And then I might later do a slightly higher office, and then maybe later a slightly higher office. So that kind of stair step often leads women to start at the school board level. But there's another dimension as well. When we think about the offices that we know best, and we think about the spaces that we'd like to make an impact, women are often drawn to school boards because they see challenges that their own children have experienced in the local school district, or they see the experiences of their friends' classmates, and they're driven to make change. Women tend to be problem solvers in politics, so the school board seems like a natural space to kind of solve that first problem. And it's there when we're really lucky, we get women who are hooked on the ability to make change, and they see from the school board position that it's really
the school board is controlled by this other entity, and then they'll run for a higher office. Of course, my ambition for women is to not think about the stair step that we've got to cover every rung on the ladder, but that women will feel the ambition and confidence to actually step out in some bolder office choices, not to diminish the school board at all, but to say that there are many pathways into politics, and I'd like women to have full access to all of those pathways.
When you talk about that being your ambition, talk to me a little bit. You often straddle your work. You are an academic, but you're also engaged in the world of policy and in the world of advocacy for women as elected officials. Talk to me a little bit about your work.
Oh, great. Thank you. I've been so watching the wonderful energy from one election cycle to the next when we can make the claim of the large numbers of women who are voting, and in particular, the ways in which women of color have been driving many election cycles. It's a beautiful kind of untold or undertold story. But my educated guess, my hypothesis has always been, if there are women who are motivated to get other people out to vote, then they also have the power to become decision makers in their own right and take seats at important tables for decision making. So running for political office. One of the great things I'm excited about that we're doing this year here at The Ohio State University and in conjunction with a community partner called the Ohio Unity Coalition, we're getting together to offer a campaign training and advocacy skills program for Black women across the state of Ohio to become involved in running for positions of leadership across our state and becoming stronger advocates in their own right. So this is something we're starting this year. We're connecting it to the Center for the American Woman in Politics is Ready to Run program. So we'll do this as a pre-conference virtual day for Black women across the state of Ohio to come together and have some discussions about how do we engage in Ohio politics. It's a very exciting moment.
It is. Now, as much as you talk about the stair-stepping, and as important as you've been for understanding women leading locally, you are part of a project that is watching and documenting, as a scholar and an academic, somebody who's not exactly local, and that is you're part of the Kamala Harris Project. Tell us about what the Kamala Harris Project is.
Sure. So this is a project that is led by a colleague, Dr. Ange Marie Hancock Alfaro, out of USC. And we are coming together as academics to really document this moment in history with the first African-American and South Asian woman president, vice president. I'm getting ahead of myself.
Okay, well, you done said it, Dr. Smooth.
But, you know, there's so much for us to learn in this political moment, because we know from our scholarship across both national and state level and local level politics is that women and women of color experience leadership differently. And we want to make sure that we are documenting and understanding the role that identity plays in the leadership style, the leadership delivery, as well leadership opportunities and the leadership barriers that women of color face. And I think that the work that we're doing is not only informative for women in formal electoral politics, but it's also quite instructive to help us to understand women of color in leadership more broadly, whether we're talking about education, medicine, or corporate America.
You and I have daughters of similar age, if I remember right. My little one is 8. So don't you have a little person around that age? Yeah, that's right. Do you all talk about politics? Do you, in, you know, here you are as an advocate and as an academic thinking about these questions. I'm wondering if, like, are y'all reading Grace for President? What's happening in the Smooth household there?
Oh, we are reading Grace for President. We're reading Stacey's Extraordinary Words. Mm. We are celebrating.
For those who don't know Stacey's Extraordinary Words, that is a children's book written by Stacey Abrams that many of us gifted to our children in recent weeks.
Absolutely. You know, we watch and we talk politics at our dinner table every night. And, you know, just this morning, it's funny you should say this, just this morning, she talked about doing a research project for Women's History Month. And she said, you know, I could help the class so much. And I said, how can you help the class so much? She says, well, I'll go through my home library and just bring lots of books so that people can really see that women are leaders. And she said it so effortlessly, right? It was just a flow off of her tongue that she wasn't making a bold statement. She just, it's just her reality. And that's what we want, right, from Melissa, for all of our girls, both those who live with us and those who for whom we're aunties far and wide. We want them to naturalize this idea that women are leaders and they lead in various sectors of society. And it's natural that we should expect women to lead. My daughter certainly, and I'm sure your daughter is the same way, she expects to be regarded as a leader.
Yes, I am reminded constantly that if you rear a child to question authority, it will be your authority that is first and foremost questioned regularly.
Right. We're the practice field.
That's right. The protest practice is happening in the kitchen.
Yes.
Professor Smooth, when I say women leading locally, what does that mean to you?
Oh, wow. Women leading locally for me means women having an opportunity to transform the course of their own lives and the lives of people that they care about. And it's around the issues that are home plate issues. What I mean by that, drinking water, crosswalks, the cost of utilities, those are all of the kinds of local issues that women leading locally can add their voice to in our society. And it makes an incredible difference because women lead different types of lives and those issues touch them very differently. So we have to have them at the table.
Wendy Smooth is Associate Professor and Associate Dean at The Ohio State University. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Our senior producer is Ethan Oberman. Shanta Covington is our planning editor. Our producers are Meg Dalton, Katarina Barton, and Deborah Goldstein. Michelle Liu is our intern. Zachary Bynum is our digital editor. Jay Cowett is our director. Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer, and he and Jay both sound designed the show. Jackie Martin is our line producer. David Gable is our administrative assistant. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.